over to Kerrigan in a bound, and he cuffed her across the face. She fell to her side and shook her head, tasting blood from a cut lip. What was left of her midday meal was a mess of crumbs on the ground. She forced herself back into a sitting position. "You're nothing but a ruffian," she told Torn. "And a coward." Torn only laughed. Kerrigan had the satisfaction, however, of knowing she had planted a seed of uncertainty in his mind. If only she could get her hands on that brooch. At present, however, it did not seem likely. They passed through numerous settlements cut out of the woods. They were too small, really, to be called villages. Woodsfolk in plain dress worked about their cabins. They hung laundry in the sweet spring air, tended gardens where enough sunlight crept through the forest canopy to nourish vegetables, and they split wood. Torn used some of the coppers he had taken from Kerrigan's pockets to purchase meat and bread, boasting all the while to the settlers about the thief he and his partner had snared. More often than not, food was offered the mercenaries for free when they heard this fabrication. Kerrigan received nothing except scowls and curses about thieves who preyed on law-abiding Sacheridians who were trying to scrape out a living in the wilderness. Some looked her up and down, disbelieving one so young and innocent-looking could be a notorious thief.
"That's part of a method," Torn explained at one settlement. "She seems innocent, but when you are not looking..."
He spread his hands wide, allowing the settlers to come to their own conclusions.
"Do you see this horse and the coat she wears? Murdered a green rider, she did."
Disturbed exclamations passed among the settlers. Just about everyone in the tiny community stood around the mercenaries and their captive. Visitors came seldom, and they were hungry for news. Kerrigan guessed these were all very decent folk, and she couldn't blame them for their accusing, if not fearful, expressions. They had probably been victims of brigands more than once. Seldom did the king's law pass through these isolated spots, except at tax time. Torn was an adept storyteller, too. Despite the blatant lies, Kerrigan didn't dare breathe a word. Jindara held her close with a dagger tip digging into her back. It was frustrating having people so close who could help her, but they had been turned against her by Torn's words.
"Bad enough with ground mites crossing the borders,"
one man muttered. He removed his leather cap and smoothed his hair back.
"Don't need our own kind killing and thieving."
"Ground mites?" Jindara asked in surprise, echoing Kerrigan's own thoughts. "Crossing the borders?"
"Aye,"
the man growled.
"Killed a family not 5 miles from here on the Putnell Trail. And not a sign of king's soldiers anywhere. We sent one of our lads to the city to find help. The rest of us sleep uneasy with what weapons we have close at hand and keep watch during the night."
"Wise precautions," Jindara said. "Ground mites crossing the borders."
"Aye, worse still. Some of our hunters found the carcass of an unnatural creature and its spawn."
Kerrigan snapped to attention as she listened.
"We wouldn't have believed it were they not our finest wood folk who found it, and honest to the core. Whatever slew the creature must be even more dangerous. Sank its great fangs into the creature's belly, it did. Makes you want to believe the old minstrel tales of Mournhaven and the Blackvale Forest."
Kerrigan wanted to laugh out loud. Maybe she ought to name her plain saber Fang, the way the great warriors named their blades, or carried blades bearing long lineages and ancient names. If they only knew who had really slain the creature. The crowd babbled about the old evil, ancient prophecies, and the long war. Kerrigan became absorbed in her own thoughts. Estrel, ever the fountain of information, had mentioned trouble on the borders. But ground mites? She had scarcely believed ground mites would dare leave their dens in the far north after they had been slain and scattered after the long war, with the fear of the League driven into their hearts. Now she felt no disbelief that the ground mites, legendary minions of Mournhaven the Black, which were not quite human, but beast-like creatures that were terrible in battle, were roaming across Sacheridia's border. There was no room for disbelief. Not after Imrez. Not after the creature of Canmer and Vane. Things were happening in the world, and her beloved Sacheridia no longer seemed very secure. A tug on her coat snapped her out of her reverie. A little boy with tousled sandy hair gaped up at her with solemn brown eyes. He couldn't have been more than 6 years old.
"You really kill someone?"
he asked in awe. Kerrigan glanced about. The settlers and the mercenaries were too deep in discussion to notice. She then looked down at the little boy.
"No." "You lying?"
"No."
"Didn't think so."
He grinned at her brightly, then ran off to join his mother, who stood off a ways with a cluster of other women. She put a protective arm about his shoulders and scowled at Kerrigan. Jindara and Torn were invited to share dinner with the settlers. Visitors bearing news from abroad were enough cause for celebration. The feast was held outdoors, for no dwelling in the area was large enough to hold more than a small family. Pots of prittle cream were passed around and smoke candles lit to stave off ravenous biters. However, no one passed Kerrigan any cream, and she was tied to an ash tree, out of range of the smoke candles, her mouth securely gagged with an old rag. As if to augment her misery, the smell of roasting meats drifted all around her. Her stomach roiled. The hard heel of bread Torn had tossed her earlier had done little to ease her hunger pains. One of the settlers stood guard a little way off. He seemed more intent on watching the festivities, his notched and rusted blade loose in his hand. She could hear music, mostly a simple pipe and drum, and laughter and clapping from dancing folk. She allowed a few tears to trickle down her cheeks. If only she still possessed the winged horse brooch or the bunchberry flower. How she missed the Berry sisters, and Estrel, and her father. Where was he now? What was he doing? Was he searching for her? Or did he assume her dead? Would she ever see him again? The tears poured down her cheeks now, and she sobbed hard, gasping for air through the gag. She was so alone. How did she ever get into this mess? She would never wish for adventure again. She just wanted to go home. Under different circumstances, she might have found the night quite pleasant. A milky moon rose far above the trees, and stars speckled the sky. The laughter of the settlers had a homey feel, but only made her more lonely. She took a deep, rattling breath and blew it out her nose slowly. A soft breeze dried her tears and whispered of summer yet to come. It would have been easy to feel happy here, comfortable, if she hadn't been tied to a tree and gagged.
"I wish I could help you."
The words drifted to her as if upon the breeze. She looked wildly about her and strained to see behind the tree, but no one was there.
"I help you."
Kerrigan sat up alertly.
"I, you, danger, the road, we spoke, girl."
Kerrigan grunted through the gag, unable to respond.
"No strength, help now. Wish could help."
Kerrigan squirmed, fighting against her bonds. Was it Freen Kobelbay trying to communicate with her? Was she crazy to think she heard the voice of a ghost?
"Not, wish help.
Fog, wonder me anyway,"
was all she could say through the gag. There was giggling all around her. Kerrigan looked up, and all the young children of the settlement gazed at her the way they might at some intriguing beast at the Corsa Zoo. In the forefront was the little boy who had spoken to her earlier that day.
"Are you a murderer?"
asked a tiny girl with her forefinger hooked in her mouth.
"What's a murderer?"
"Hush, tosh," the boy said knowingly. "She's not a murderer. She told me so."
"Maybe she's crazy," another boy said. "My old aunt was crazy, and they locked her in the attic."
The rest of the children were duly impressed.
"What's a murderer?"
the tiny girl asked.
"Means she killed someone," the first boy said.
Kerrigan cleared her throat, and they all jumped. The boy looked surreptitiously around, then gazed at Kerrigan with a very serious expression on his face.
"You have to promise not to talk. Not loud, anyway."
Kerrigan nodded emphatically. The boy looked around again, then pulled the gag out of her mouth. She took some deep breaths, then said,
"I didn't kill anyone."
The children jumped again at her voice, but they seemed willing to believe her.
What are you all doing here? Won't you get in trouble for talking to me?
Dad's too sleepy. Drank too much cider.
Then the boy pointed to the guard, whose back was still turned to them.
You gotta keep real quiet, remember? Then we won't get in trouble. We came to look at you.
Now Kerrigan did feel like a strange beast in the zoo. Well then, go away. I don't like being stared at. It's not polite. The Barry sisters would approve. The children giggled, especially when she made an ugly face. They skipped away, chattering excitedly among themselves in hushed voices. They had done the forbidden by speaking to her, and were full of it. Only the sandy-haired boy remained behind, and Kerrigan now saw he held a dish heaped with scraps of food.
I couldn't eat it. You can have it.
Kerrigan was about to compare herself to a beggar dog, but was too hungry to care. She lowered her face to the dish while he held it, and ate greedily. She licked the plate clean. She wasn't even sure what it was she had eaten, but her stomach felt full for the first time in days.
What's your name? She asked him.
Dusty.
Thank you, Dusty. Thank you.
He smiled shyly, then, without warning, stuffed the gag back in her mouth. He ran off to join his friends. Kerrigan watched after him with regret. She had been about to ask him to untie her. Except for the one trip to the latrine to relieve herself, she had been left tied to the tree in the cramped position. When morning came and Torn made her stand up, she nearly fell to her knees. He stood by impatiently while she rubbed some feeling back into her legs. The greatcoat weighed more than before, and the pockets bulged against her thighs. When Torn wasn't looking, she slipped her hands into a pocket and found it was stuffed with what felt like dried meat, cheese, hard bread, and an apple. Dusty and his friends must have filled her pockets while she slept. They didn't want to see her go hungry. When she could finally walk without too much discomfort, Torn secured her wrists in front of her. He leaned over and whispered in her ear,
"One word from you, and Jindara's knife will slide right into your back. Should I gag you?"
Kerrigan shook her head. One night of that foul gag in her mouth had been quite enough. The three of them walked from the settlement with Torn in the lead, Kerrigan in the middle, and Jindara leading the horse very close behind. The folk patted Torn and Jindara on the back or shook hands, wishing them good speed. Kerrigan was wished a good hanging. The children were there too and waved their goodbyes emphatically. Kerrigan winked and smiled at her miniature benefactors in return. An angry father who noted the exchange threw a stone at her, which missed her shoulder by a hand's breadth, but she didn't care. Even with the animosity of the settlers surrounding her, and the grim outlook of days of travel with Torn and Jindara, something good had happened here. She had made new friends among the children when all others scorned her, and when she had been at her loneliest. When they were out of earshot of the settlers, Torn chuckled,
"Suckers, feed him a story, and you can get anything you want."
The horses' saddlebags were crammed with food.
"Maybe we ought to do this sort of thing full-time."
Jindara shrugged her shoulders indifferently.
"It's annoying, dragging a prisoner around."
She glanced at Kerrigan. Kerrigan wondered once again who the two had been prior to becoming mercenaries. Weapons. Kerrigan received her answer later that afternoon. The day dragged along until the horse froze in his tracks, his ears laid flat. He sidestepped nervously and patches of sweat darkened his neck and flanks. Torn hauled on the reins as if he could forcibly drag the horse down the road. When the horse stayed anchored to his spot, Torn cursed and threatened him.
"He senses something ahead," Kerrigan said, weariness weighing her words down.
She could not have cared less if the mercenaries walked into some sort of trouble, but Torn's hand was on the hilt of his sword, and it looked as if he was going to use more than threats to move the horse this time.
"Go on, horse," she said.
The horse flickered an ear at her, but balked no longer. They walked on, and soon discovered what had stopped him. Strewn across the road, and alongside it, was a jumble of bodies.
"King soldiers," Jindara said without emotion.
In a flash, the mercenaries unsheathed their swords. That was when Kerrigan saw the black bands on their blades, which marked the two as sword masters.
As such, they probably were, or had been, either tomb guards or the king's personal guards, truly an elite order of soldier. They took oaths which bound them for life to the royal family, and even beyond life. Some were bound to protect the dead and the avenues of kings and queens from desecration, and to guard against potential grave robbers lured by the priceless relics of ages long past, entombed with royalty. No too few guards were interred near their wards. They were the finest sword fighters found in all Sacheridia. Armsmaster Rendell had told her that such guards, even without their blades, were human weapons. In fact, they were often referred to as weapons. Kerrigan had been too shocked during the ambush to notice the bands on their blades before. Their status as weapons explained their ineptitude in the wilderness, but not why they were now scraping around as mercenaries. Weapons were revered for their skills, and though they did not live in absolute luxury, they lived at least as well as the lower nobility, in large houses with servants to attend to their needs. Even after retirement, they held honored places in the king's court. Many often became counselors to the king or trained the next generation of guards bound to the royal family. Kerrigan found it hard to believe Torn and Jindara had left Sacher City and their privileges voluntarily. Crows flew squawking into the trees as Jindara and Torn picked their way among the bodies. Larger carrion birds hopped, wings extended, only a few paces away. The weapons checked pockets and packs of the dead for valuable trinkets or coins, but the two were out of luck. Whoever had slain the soldiers had done a thorough search already. The breeze shifted, and Kerrigan gagged on the stench of rotting corpses. Looks like they were ambushed by ground mites. Jindara sheathed her sword, as if ground mites were no cause for concern.
The Grey One has been busy, Torn said.
He beckoned for Kerrigan and the horse to follow. Kerrigan covered her nose and mouth with her hands and tried not to look down, but she had to look where she stepped. Bodies lay twisted and entwined, and it was impossible to tell where one stopped and another started. Crawling beetles created a sense of movement among the dead. The silver of uniforms glared in the sun as if to mock the pride and honor with which the soldiers had once donned the colors of Sacheridia. Grim faces bloated in the sun unseeing. Carrion birds had picked out their eyes. Among the human dead were a few not-so-human remains. Kerrigan couldn't tell if it was death that made the skin of these large creatures yellowish-brown, or if it was their natural coloring. The skin was covered with patches of mud-colored fur. Open mouths, as if in the midst of howling at the moment of death, were armed with sharp canines. Their ears were pointed and furred like a cat's. Ground mites. Three human heads were impaled on lances by the roadside. What remained of a captain hung from a tree, his stomach split and gutted. Two black-shafted arrows with red fletching pierced his heart. Kerrigan vomited. It took considerable time to coax the horse across the corpse-strewn road, much longer than she could bear. She wanted to run, to leave the grisly scene far behind her, but she knew it would return to her in her dreams, no matter how far away she went.
That horse would never survive a battle,
Torn said, watching the miserable Kerrigan tug on the reins.
Greenies are worthless in battle.
Jindara's voice was full of contempt.
They gallop across the countryside on horses is all. I'm surprised they even carry swords.
Kerrigan felt as green as her greatcoat, and kept walking even after she had come to the end of the carnage. The mercenaries trotted to catch up with her. Behind them, the carrion birds flopped back among the corpses to resume their feeding. Kerrigan was sick several more times. Blood and gore clung to her boots, and no amount of scraping them on the road seemed to rub it off. When a stream appeared alongside the road, she ran to it so fast that even quick Jindara could not root her. Kerrigan stood there in the stream, her eyes closed, willing the rush of water to cleanse her feet and her mind.
Back on the road, Jindara ordered.
When Kerrigan opened her eyes, she was staring down the black banded blade. Torn stood in the middle of the road, his head thrown back in laughter.
A murderer who can't stand the sight of blood.
Kerrigan ignored him and locked her gaze with Jindara's. Were you a tomb god or a king's god, swordmaster? Jindara squinted, as if the glare off her own blade blinded her. A frown tugged at the corners of her mouth.
I do not guard the dead.
Then why do you betray the king?
I do not betray the king, not the rightful king.
Kerrigan raised her brows. The only sound was the stream flowing around her ankles. Just what had Jindara meant by that? There was only one king, Zachary. The blow was so fast, Kerrigan didn't see it coming. Jindara slammed the flat of her sword on Kerrigan's collarbone and sent her nerves ringing with its force. She splashed to her knees, cold water soaking through her trousers.
I serve the rightful king, Jindara hissed. Do not forget it.
She grabbed Kerrigan's collar, hauled her out of the stream, and shoved her down the road. Torn was laughing again, or perhaps he had never stopped. Kerrigan staggered after her captors, dizzy and empty from vomiting repeatedly, but relieved her boots, at least, were clean. Days came and went. Kerrigan lost count of how many. Hands tied before her, she trudged along with the mercenaries. She was only able to keep on because of the food Dusty had slipped in her pockets. She nibbled at it when the mercenaries weren't looking, or were asleep. Even with the food in her pockets, she dreamed of feasting on goose and fresh-baked bread, of sugared apple fritters and sharp cheese. One night, while Torn snored on the opposite side of the campfire, and Jindara sat at watch with her back to Kerrigan, Kerrigan slipped her hand into her pocket. Her mouth watered in anticipation, and her stomach rumbled. Torn had given her nothing to eat all day. She pulled out a strip of dried meat. She chewed and swallowed hastily, yet savored every bit. So intent on the food was she that she did not notice Jindara gazing at her until it was too late. The swordmaster's eyes glinted in the firelight. Kerrigan tensed, readying herself for another blow, for more pain, for Jindara to rouse Torn. She stuffed the rest of the meat strip into her mouth, not willing to be denied one last morsel. She glared defiantly at Jindara. The swordmaster, however, did not twitch a muscle. She did not wake Torn, nor did she leap over to Kerrigan and strike her, or demand that she empty her pockets of the hidden food. She spoke not a word. She simply blinked her eyes and turned her gaze back to the depths of the night woods, her back rigid. Kerrigan was not about to question her motives. When Kerrigan didn't dream of food, she dreamed of retrieving the brooch and fantasized about what she would do with the saber if she were invisible. She dreamed also of her mother's ring, which Jindara wore. Sometimes she dreamed that her mother chastised her for her carelessness. Other times her mother held her in a warm embrace, the seal of Clan Glathian seeming to come to life behind them. The roar of the ocean, the creak of ship timbers, the cry of gulls. Then she would awaken to a reality much stranger than all her dreams together. How did a simple schoolgirl ever get into such a mess? Travelers on the road watched the trio curiously. Torn told his story many times, Jindara sticking her knife tip into Kerrigan's back, lest she speak out. Torn's embellishments, Kerrigan thought, were getting a little wild, and if he wasn't careful, he would one day betray himself. One afternoon, he pulled aside an old trapper riding a mule.
Down the road, you'll come to a terrible sight, Torn warned the man. King's soldiers, slain, every last one.
The trapper rubbed his bristly gray beard, eyes wide.
All dead, you say? How?
Ground mites, Torn said. Surely you've heard of them raiding the borders.
Aye, but you will see. But see also this girl.
Torn pointed at Kerrigan, and the trapper followed with his gaze.
I see her. She is responsible.
The trapper plucked at the laces of his coarse wool shirt.
Responsible? She is? For what?
The massacre.
I thought you said ground mites. She led them there,
Torn said fervently.
She led the massacre. She slew many of the guards herself. And what she did to the captain? unspeakable.
He shook his head. The trapper raised a skeptical brow and cleared his throat, as if to say something. Then he eyed Torn's sword and thought better of it.
We take this girl, this traitor,
Torn spat the word,
for judgment in Sacca City. She eluded us at first, but we caught her, planning another raid with her ground mite cohorts on an innocent settlement.
Aye, well, must be going. Good day to you.
The trapper slapped his mule into a hasty trot, trailing a plume of road dust behind him. Torn beamed his gap-toothed grin at Jindara, pleased with his own performance. She groaned and rolled her eyes. Some folk Torn told the story to were all too ready to believe it, and suggested a roadside hanging for Kerrigan. Torn protested, and declared himself a good citizen, willing to let the king's law decide her fate. She wondered what king he was talking about. Jindara was tiring of his stories as well.
Do you have to blather on to everyone we meet? I never took you for the minstrel type.
I'm not a spineless minstrel. I'm being neighborly. Besides, it unsettles folks to see a girl tied up by two warriors like us, especially when she wears that green coat.
Kerrigan had refused to remove it, no matter how warm the weather, for fear Torn would discover her hidden caches of food and take it away from her.
Well, I'm getting tired of the story. If you don't watch yourself, you'll over-embellish and give us away. Your tongue is not nearly as glib as a true minstrel's.
My sword work is what's glib.
Jindara looked away from him with a frown of disgust on her face. Dusk shadowed the road. A mounted figure appeared ahead of them riding at a walk, his movements smooth and fluid. Torn squinted his eyes, then unexpectedly whooped in recognition. He ran forward to greet the horseman. Kerrigan's heart sank. Imerez? The gray one Jindara and Torn murmured about? In the hands of Imerez, her chances of escape slimmed considerably. But as the rider approached, she saw he wasn't Merwellian at all. He wore no scarlet, but a leather jerkin emblazoned with an eagle grasping a human skull in its talons. A mercenary.
Garoti! Torn cried. What chance meeting is this?
The other man grinned, and the effect was grotesque. His face was misshapen by dozens of scars and a wad of tobacco stuffed in his left cheek. Gray-brown hair hung in a ponytail down his back. His arms were ropey with muscles and veins. The eagle and skull were tattooed onto his left forearm, like an oversized bruise.
The talons have given me a fortnight's leave, and I'm traveling. Good to see you, Torn.
His voice was gravelly and low.
I see you travel still in beautiful company.
His eyes drifted first to a smoldering Jindara, then rested on Kerrigan.
And who is this? A greenie we're delivering to the Morellians, for profit. Ah, yes, profit.
He leaned over his horse's withers and spat tobacco.
You are a merc's pride, Torn, seeking profit. But you were not very good at it when I took you under my wing when you fled the city, were you?
We've improved, I assure you.
Garoti snorted.
Profit is of little meaning to you, except if it helps sustain you in service to your master. This smells more like politics to me.
What do you know of politics?
Jindara asked. Her countenance suggested he knew nothing.
I know who you work for, beautiful.
Jindara bridled.
You will address me by my name.
Garoti shrugged.
Why don't you camp with us tonight? Torn asked eagerly. We could catch up on things.
Why don't you keep going?
Jindara suggested, an unfriendly smile on her face.
I accept your invitation,
he said to Torn. He turned to Jindara.
Nothing could keep me away from your lovely companion.
Kerrigan wished he would follow Jindara's advice. The weapon's animosity toward him made her nervous. Garoti's easy seat on his battle horse, his ugly grin, and all too interested glances did not reassure her at all. Torn and Garoti stayed up front, conversing about weapons and war, other mercs they had both known. Garoti remained arrogantly mounted while the others walked. Torn had to crane his neck to look up at his friend. Jindara strode behind with Kerrigan, leading the horse in brooding silence. Kerrigan wondered what caused Jandara to loathe the mercenary so. They walked until nightfall and settled beside the road around a little campfire. Kerrigan leaned against the rough bark of a pine, huddled in her greatcoat. She wanted to stay as far away from Garoti as she could, but his coarse laughter assaulted her ears and echoed down the road. He spoke of profitable campaigns his company had engaged in.
"I tell you, Torn, some of those villages in Rovni are ripe to pluck, especially in the wine country, and the winches there don't carry swords."
He grinned at Jandara. She glared back.
"Sakuridia is a bit too peaceful for profit," Garoti said. "That's what I think. There's always something happening down in the Underkingdoms, though. Petty lords trying to reshape the map. This year's been good for many merc companies."
"Stick around, my friend," Torn said. "There are those in Sakuridia who would change things as well."
"Maybe so, but Zachary is a strong leader. It would take a united front, maybe more, to bring him down. The governors might not like him a lot, but the common folk do. And what the governors don't need is an uprising among the common folk. Nothing would get done. The harvest would rot in the fields. Paper makers would stop their mills. The governor's wealth would dwindle. Simple as that."
"Then what are you and your company doing here in Sakuridia?" Jandara said. "If it's so unlikely, there will be an uprising."
"Ah, now we come to it. Rumors, beautiful. Rumors, no doubt begun by your employer, and designed to create unrest. I've even heard of a woman who has convinced a good many common folk that Sakuridia has no need for any king at all. Not enough to start a rebellion, but enough to spread dissent. And her ideas are catching on. The tellings are here in case an uprising does occur in Sakuridia. It would prove more profitable than anything that has ever happened in the Underkingdoms. Imagine the governors uniting to bring down the king. Talk about profit. If your employer is as good as he claims, the peace Sakuridia has enjoyed for centuries will be shattered. There is nothing better than civil war if you're a merc. Captain Haler of the Talons has eyes and ears in the courts of most provinces. Wouldn't hurt to encourage a profitable situation now, would it?"
Kerrigan listened to this with wide eyes. Much more was going on in Sakuridia than she had ever dreamed. Did this sort of speculation always go on, or was there really a threat to Sakuridia's peace? There was always intrigue. The Barry sisters had said as much. Intrigue was as much a game in real life as it was on a board. But surely, threats to the king were not commonplace, nor the threat of civil war.
"You expect mercenaries can encourage the governors in civil war?" she asked Garoti.
His smile was feral in the dancing light of the fire. It made her feel like dinner, and she was sorry she had drawn his attention.
"So, the greenie speaks."
He leaned to the side and spat.
"Of course we seek to influence what would be in our best interests. Civil war means work. Work means profit. Men of the Talon Company are wise in the ways of such things. They merely encourage the governors to do what is right. And should they do what's right, Talons will be strategically placed to negotiate contracts with the highest bidders. It's more convenient to hire a company of well-trained soldiers than to raise a rabble army of commoners."
Kerrigan shook her head. Outsiders were trying to create a civil war in Sakuridia for profit. As the daughter of a merchant, she understood the nature of profit, but at what cost? The very idea was gruesome. Quite suddenly, she felt an urgent need to reach the king with the message Freyan Kobolbe had entrusted her to carry. But she was caught up in a hopeless situation, held captive by two swordmasters, and now accompanied by a seasoned mercenary. Mirwell. Warm air flowing through an unshuttered window cleared out stale air, which had accumulated in the library chamber throughout the lengthy northern winter. What a change mild air was, and for once, without that damp, chill wind. A bee droned along the flowered vine growing just outside the window, and the air smelled of fresh green things and lilacs. The square of sky framed by the window was brilliant and clear. On such days, it was said, you could see Mount Mantahop of the Wingsong Range from the Fortress Gate Towers. Merwell scoffed at that. In all his years, he had never seen it. The range was just an indistinguishable line of nubs and bumps, far, far away on the horizon. He sipped from his goblet of rhubarb wine and stared into the embers of the day fire, allowing the wine to warm him from inside. Despite the influx of summer-like warmth, the old stone fortress was dim, and if you weren't careful, in a perpetual state of damp and mildew. Mold grew in the dark corners, which his servants battled constantly with soap and scrub brushes. The damp made his bones ache. He could never seem to keep warm, not satisfactorily anyway, and he suspected it was unhealthy to reside in the dank fortress. His personal mender advocated he leave his library chamber and soak up the sun outside, but there was too much to do. This was no time for catnapping in the sun. The efficient Beryl Spencer sat across from him in a straight-backed chair, her nose buried in half a dozen sheaves of paper. She must be nearsighted. He would have to look into getting her fitted for a pair of specs, but he hated the idea of wrecking her lovely oval face with glass and wire. Besides, the lenses would no doubt cost a pretty fortune. "The clan is presently headed by Stevic Glathian," she said. It was his only daughter, Carrigan, who provoked Lord Temus. She hasn't been seen or heard of since running away.
"Tell me about the clan," Merwell said, intrigued by how Beryl's scarlet uniform deepened her rosy, healthy cheeks.
"It's based in Corsa. No surprise there. Corsa is home to many merchant clans due to its outstanding deep water harbors. Glathian invests heavily in shipping, but is not a dominant holder in any single ship."
"Wise of him. The more diverse his holdings, the less risk to his fortune. He does have a fortune, doesn't he?"
Beryl looked up at him with those pale green eyes of hers, glistening like the gems that were her namesake. "Stevic Glathian is perhaps the single wealthiest person in all the provinces. Last year's Merchant Guild's year-end reckoning had him the highest-grossing member."
"Therefore, not a man to anger if his wealth is any indication of his influence. What does he deal in?"
Beryl scanned her papers. "Textiles and spices, mainly. Some lumber and paper. Much of his trading is done inland, via river cog and wagon train. He has strong ties with Rovni, and has even traded ice in the Cloud Islands. Very clever of him to find such a market in the tropics. According to some of your relations, my lord, he doesn't venture often into Merwell Province."
"No wonder I've heard little of him. Do any of my relations consider him a threat?"
"No, my lord. Though, just in case, they traced some of his personal history. He is the clan founder. Clan Glathian has existed for some 20 years. Merwell snorted.
"A bought clanship, I've no doubt."
"Glathian worked hard for it, starting with small merchant families to learn the trade. He's intelligent to have accumulated such wealth over so short a time." Was that admiration in Beryl's voice? "Here's an interesting bit of information. About 35 years ago, he served on the merchant vessel Gold Hunter, which used tactics of questionable legality during peacetime to acquire goods for trade."
"Explain."
"The crew practiced piracy, my lord, mostly around the Underkingdoms. They wreaked havoc with the sugar and tobacco trades." Merwell raised his brows.
"More interesting by the moment. Any idea of what capacity he served as on this vessel?"
"No, my lord."
"What became of the ship?"
"It was sold and re-registered as SMV Avrin's Pride, and became something of a coastal scow transporting granite and lumber. It was lost somewhere in Outer Ullam Bay 15 years ago.
"I see no immediate threat from this Glathian fellow."
Merwell sipped his wine. It was just the right amount of dry, balanced with sweet. It did not rival the fine vintages produced in the lake country of Rovni, but in a pinch, it would do. Vintners couldn't seem to grow grapes in Sacaridia's sandy soil,
so cider and fruit wines served as staples. Unless Rovan was to be had, of course.
Good work, Spence. Keep the information on hand just in case he turns into an overwrought father. Should he cause us trouble, I'm sure our good friend Aus Corian of the Underkingdoms would be interested in hearing about him. And we may have our own uses for the information.
Yes, my lord. Anything else? Merwell rubbed a sweaty hand on his thigh. He could think of countless things she could do for him. He felt a certain thrill at the idea of what she could do for him tingle all the way down to his loins. Would voicing his desire wreck her fealty and efficiency? Or would it bind her closer to him?
Paul,
Randy, old man, he thought, not displeased by the response of his libido. But she was too effective as his aid, and he feared ruining her devotion. Should she make the first advance herself, however? She never would. He was a grizzled old man, and she was more intent on making a place for herself in his court hierarchy with pure hard work. She had moved swiftly up the ranks during her term in Sacaridia's regular militia, and had given it all up to serve her governor and home province. The chance she had taken paid off, and here she was working her way up in his own provincial militia. Ambition was a trait Merwell admired, and honest ambition rare enough.
Ah, well, at least I can enjoy my dirty thoughts.
My lord?
Eh?
Anything else? Now she must think him a dotty old fool, leering at her like that.
Send in Hamilton,
he said, then amended.
Prince Hamilton.
Very well, my lord. Merwell watched after her with longing and regret, and observed how her every movement was graceful, yet held a stillness like a deer in the woods, alert but calm, and not prone to excessive motion. She reminded him of the weapons, but their movements were always precise and lacking beauty. Ah, if he were a younger man, then maybe. But now he must set aside his thoughtful maunderings and get on with his great work. The glory of his clan was more important than anything else, and Hamilton had been insistent about seeing him today. Merwell had put him off all morning and most of the afternoon. By now, the prince would be angry enough to spit venom.
There are ways,
the governor told the bearhead mounted on the opposite wall,
of showing who is in control. Subtle ways, mind you.
The bear had once exerted her control on him in a non-too-subtle way. It was she who had maimed his right side. He had been careless during the hunt, had gotten between the mother and the cubs. The bear mauled him, and it was perhaps his injuries which had prevented him from siring another son, though he was always certain to blame his wives. He could not be perceived as weak in any of his ventures. Too bad the wife who bore Temus had been so short and mean. The boy had acquired her temperament and size. Half-dead and ravaged from bear claws and teeth, Merwell had hunted down and killed the mother bear, with nothing more than his own stubborn will and a dagger, just to prove he was not weak. He skinned her and ate of her raw heart, still warm and pulsating with blood. As he chewed, bear blood gushed in runnels down his beard and neck and into his gaping wounds, blending with his own streaming blood. This, he thought, made their strength one. Then, out of pity, he killed the mewling little cubs, too little to survive without their mother. Of the bear pelts, he made a mantle to wear on state occasions as a reminder to others of his strength. Prince Hamilton entered the chamber, glowering. His bodyguards, simple Merwellian guards, posted themselves outside the doorway. Not that he needed guards in the governor's house, but he had become dependent on his two weapons, who usually never left his side, and now they were somewhere out in the great wide wilderness, tracking the greenie, and leaving him, in his mind, vulnerable. Regular militia made a poor substitute for one used to the fanatical, servile devotion exhibited by weapons. Merwell liked the idea of a more vulnerable Hamilton. It made the prince more malleable. Hamilton was dressed in elegant silks with a purple scarf tied prettily around his collar. useless clothes more suited to impressing court butterflies than anything else. He did attract his share of female attention, but to what practical end? The governor preferred a military look himself, and no one in his court, not even the ladies, wore such lavish fabrics or colors. Hamilton looked a butterfly in House Merwell. Merwell touched his brow and inclined his head, not deeply, but not insolently either. He was excused from a full formal bow because of his old hunting wounds.
"Wine, my prince?" he inquired.
Hamilton waved a contemptuous hand at Merwell and faced the fire. Merwell poured him a goblet full anyway, and with great effort limped over to the hearth to give it to him. Hamilton took it wordlessly and poured the contents on the floor. Merwell watched, unblinking.
"How may I serve you, my prince?"
Hamilton turned on him, his expression haughty. His face was narrower, more sharp and severe than his brother's, but he had the brown, almond-shaped eyes that characterized Clan Hillander.
"You shall not serve me, the bottled urine you call wine." "I beg forgiveness, liege. Roven is difficult to come by, and we save it for more extravagant occasions."
It was no wonder the late king had chosen Zachary to rule. Hamilton was a spoiled fop.
"You seem reluctant," Hamilton said, "to update me in the affairs concerning my brother."
"Missives from Captain Emery's are few. He is hard on the road to ensure our plans go forward without mishap. You know as much about his progress as I do."
"It seems I could have sent my own assassins months ago, and have had done with it."
"Of course, we've tried that avenue to no avail. It lacked finesse. The assassins were promptly thwarted."
"Yes, because you've permitted spies into your house, who learned your plans. And my brother knows where I am."
"If your brother knew the source of those assassins, don't you think his weapons would be upon us now? And why should he care where you are, so long as it is far away from Sacker City, my liege? We only suspect there is a spy in House Merwell."
"I believe my brother was suspicious enough of those last attempts to put a spy here. How do you know our next attempt won't fail?"
"Every precaution is being taken, liege. You must trust me in this."
"I sincerely hope you don't fail this time, Tomas."
Hamilton left his goblet on the mantel and moved restlessly about the chamber. He paused by the open window which looked over the training fields of the provincial militia and allowed the implied threat to hang in the air before he spoke again.
"And you trust this Gray One?"
"Explicitly. He is of the old powers, and his alliance will bring such influence and glory to us that we can't even begin to imagine it."
Hamilton leaned against the windowsill, arms crossed, his trim, angular figure silhouetted against blue sky.
"I don't particularly care for his ways. The ground mites, you know. But the Grey One's forces ought to convince the other governors and nobles to ally with me."
"His forces are great enough to take a province at a time, if necessary,"
Merwell said.
"And he has offered you powers?"
"Not precisely. I fear he may betray us, and offer them to my brother first."
"It would be easiest for the Grey One, in his own self-interest, to do so."
"I agree."
"Let us not fret," Merwell said. "He'll have trouble convincing your brother that the dire wall should be crushed. Zachary is far too scrupulous."
"And I'm not."
Not even a trace of a smile could be found on Hamilton's lips. Wisely, Merwell didn't respond. He was growing used to Hamilton's little tirades.
"My father took what was mine by right of succession, and gave it to my brother. Do you know the humiliation I experienced when he was pronounced heir? I wanted to gut him right there in the throne room. Right there, in front of my father and his counselors, and those smirking Lord Governors and Clan Chiefs. He was always favored in father's eyes. He always exceeded me in his studies. He excelled in hunting and riding. He revived the old Hillander terrier breed, and his kennel is the envy of the country."
"He sounds very impressive," Merwell said. "But a man cannot be judged by his kennels."
Now Hamilton did smile, but it was fleeting.
If I'd the sense, I'd have seen to my father's death before he had a chance to announce an heir. I'd be king now, and I would have the control over my brother's life instead of he over mine. Then we would see who the exiled one was.
Merwell gazed down at his intrigue board. Little had changed on it since Imrez last reported. He picked up the Red King, its enamel paint chipped and scratched, and rotated it in his fingers.
Hindsight, my prince, will not change the future. There is no use dwelling in it. Your brother does lack certain qualities which are in your favor.
Such as?
Such as ambition. You and I share that particular quality, and it is always the downfall of one who is as scrupulous as your brother. We will make Sacharidia great, you and I.
He set the Red King on the fringes of the Green King's realm. Ambition was a healthy attribute for a man in his waning years. It kept him thinking young and prepared his clan for the ages to come. Once Hamilton ascended the throne, Adelind and Lepetri provinces, the poorest and richest provinces in Sacharidia, would be incorporated into his own. Adelind, because it bordered him to the north, and it contained millions of acres of virgin timber, enough to feed paper mills and shipyards for the next few centuries, and Lepetri for its harbors, fishing fleet, and prosperous trade city, Corsa. It was also on the southeast corner of his border. There would be little resistance, if any. Both provinces had militia that were laughable at best, and if there was a problem, the Grey One and King Hamilton would back him up with their forces.
You will prevail, my prince,
Merwell said.
You will prevail.
That is, he thought,
if Imrez stops that greenie in time.
Stevik Glavion. Stevik Glavion caught wind of a bad omen as he rode his sorrel stallion through the gates of Selium. An undertaker's cart stood pulled to the side of the street. The ancient nag harnessed to it dozed in the sun, oblivious to the flies that swarmed around her tearing eyes and that which lay beneath the blanket in the cart. The undertaker, an old man with a stubble beard, leaned against the cart on his forearms. His worn clothing, hole-ridden trousers, and a frayed waistcoat held together by patches were smeared with mud and dirt, as if he had just returned from grave digging. Stevik Glavion, whose own clothing was of the richest fabrics and finest make, wrinkled his nose. A woman in green joined the old man. Her hair, like new copper, was bound in a single braid down her back. A winged horse was embroidered in gold on the left sleeve of her short coat, and a saber girded at her side.
I can smell what's in that cart from here.
Stevik smiled grimly at his cargo master, Savano, who rode next to him on a gray mare.
It's not what I think of when I think of Selium, Stevik said. I'm surprised they let that undertaker through the gates.
As they rode past the cart, the woman lifted the blanket. She clapped her hand over her mouth and nose. Whether she was shocked to see the corpse of someone she knew, or was reacting to the stench of decay, he couldn't tell.
Found him on the side of the road,
the undertaker said in a gruff voice.
Had to have been there a while, I reckon.
Would have left him there.
But I'm not that way. Some fellas would let a corpse rot in the open if someone weren't there to pay for a proper burial. I can give you a real decent deal on a pine box if you're inclined.
Was there any sign of a horse nearby? Was the surprising response.
Nothing but my old cob here within miles, Cap'n. Now how about that box?
The woman dropped the blanket and grabbed him by his lapels. His eyes bulged and his arms dangled helplessly at his sides as she shook him. Did you see anything lying near the body? She demanded. A satchel of any kind? Tack?
No, nothing.
Stevik and the cargo master hurried past the unpleasant scene at a trot. After a while, Stevik pulled on the reins and looked back. The undertaker had disappeared, and the woman held two arrows at eye level. A frown tugged at the corners of her mouth. Savano followed Stevik's gaze.
Green Rider, he muttered. Always like a raven before the storm, bearing ill news, whatever one turns up.
It sometimes seemed true that the king's messengers bore only bad news. From strife, illness, and death, to new taxes. Some likened crossing the path of a green rider to meeting disaster. Stevic knew otherwise. Years ago, a green rider had brought news of Queen Eisen's approval for the chartering of Clan Glavion. The rider had stayed on to witness the confirmation ceremony, and turned out to be a jolly entertainer during the reception that followed. Stevic and Savano rode through the late afternoon bustle of Selium. Crafters hawked their wares and stalls, and tourists milled around street musicians, who played ballads for coppers. Steam rose from vents in the roofs of bathhouses. Despite the outrageous rates chalked outside on slates, long lines formed outside, and business was thriving. If not for the hot springs, commerce in the city would be considerably slower. Students, in their indigo, green, maroon, gold, and brown uniforms, created a motley scene as they wove in and out of the crowds, or sat on the front steps of the art museum. Some shared notes and gossip while others sketched. Some played involved games of intrigue as pigeons cooed and stalked the steps in search of handouts. The old longing swelled within Sevik's chest as he took in the scene, a wistful longing to be a student here himself. He hadn't the wealth when a youth to study at Selium. Indeed, his family had dragged what meager living they could out of the sea. At a young age, he could master a sloop and haul weighted nets alongside his brother and sisters. As he spent a portion of each day gutting or scaling fish to be dried, he dreamed, oh, how he dreamed, of the Golden Guardian searching in his poor village for hidden talent, and finding it within him. Alas, it remained a dream, for the Golden Guardian had never come to his obscure village. Stevic saw the life of a fisherman as the bleakest possible future, and no longer able to endure the stink of dead fish and their scales clinging to his skin. He ran away. Instead of a refined education immersed in the arts and history, he was educated through life experience in the employ of various merchants. He learned to read and tally figures. His first employer had seen to that, and traveled to places he could never have imagined. But he missed a classical education. In the midst of the conviviality of Selium's main thoroughfare, and absorbed by his own regrets, he almost forgot the unpleasant summons that had brought him here. The charges against Kerrigan were preposterous, of course, and he planned to straighten it all out with Dean Geyer. If nothing else, currency would convince the Dean of his mistake. Pink apple blossoms drifted into the street, filling the air with a far sweeter fragrance than the corpse down by the gates. Stevic had traveled lightly, though tempted to bring along a caravan of goods now that the spring trading season had opened and people were in the mood to buy. However, his daughter's plight was more important, and he made what speed he could, bringing along Savano, who was talented with a sword despite his age, and welcome company. Up the Grangent River, they had sailed from Corsa, on one of Stevic's own cargo barges. They had left it unburdened of goods for speed. From the river, it was a 2-day ride to Selium. Stevic sent Savano to arrange for rooms at the Harp and Drum, where he stayed whenever he was in town. The inn was clean and tapped into the city's famous hot springs. Each evening, students performed in the common room. The inn provided an opportunity for aspiring minstrels to practice their craft in a real situation, and to earn coppers and silvers for tuition at the same time. Stevic had hoped Kerrigan would take a liking to music-making, but it appeared she hadn't the aptitude for it. Exactly what she had an aptitude for remained a mystery, though Dean Geyer hinted in his letter that it was for nothing but trouble. Stevic had crushed the letter in his fist and thrown it into the fire. His daughter was headstrong, but she was also intelligent. One just had to know how to direct her energies. The closer Stevic got to campus, the quieter the street became, as the mercantiles, inns, bathhouses, craft booths, and tourists fell behind. Grand houses now huddled close together on both sides of the street. They were old and similar in style to the academic buildings, with pretentious columns supporting overhanging roofs of red clay tile. Sharp angles and corners cast stark shadows against pale walls, scenes carved in relief ornamented entryways. Over one door, the god and goddess glowed in the sunlight. Narrow, tall windows